From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! The Republicans retake the Senate, strengthen their majority in the House, a mandate about a third of registered voters went to the polls nationwide. This as the United States pushes its war resolution in the UN Security Council. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Republicans seize full control of Congress, retaking the Senate. The Republicans now have control of the White House, the Senate, and the House of Representatives. The outcome is a break with historic patterns in which the party that controls the White House almost invariably loses seats in midterm congressional elections. At the time of this broadcast, with the numbers not all in, it appears only one-third of U.S. citizens came out to vote. The Republicans picked up at least 22 of the 34 contested Senate seats, giving them at least 51 seats. Republicans also strengthened their control of the House. Republican control of the full Congress became clear shortly before 2 a.m. when Democratic Senator Jean Carnahan conceded defeat to Republican challenger Congressmember Jim Talent in Missouri. Talent's victory also means that Republicans will be in the majority when Congress returns this month. Carnahan was filling the unexpired term of her husband, who was killed in a plane crash shortly before the 2000 election. Under Missouri law, Talent can be sworn into office immediately. Also this morning, news organizations projected Norm Coleman to be the winner in the tight Minnesota race for Senate. Former Vice President Walter Mondale joined the race a week ago following the death of Democratic Senator Paul Wellstone. In New Jersey, former Democratic Senator Frank Lautenberg defeated Republican business executive Doug Forrester. Lautenberg was put on the ballot after Senator Robert Torricelli quit. In among the most watched races for governor, the president's brother, Jeb Bush, easily won the governor's race in Florida. New York Governor George Pataki won over Democrat Carl McCall, and in California, Democratic Governor Gray Davis beat Republican businessman Bill Simon. In addition, Peter Miguel Camejo gained 5% of the vote in one of the Green Party's most successful campaigns. We'll speak with Camejo later in the show. Bush mounted a very aggressive campaign in the final days, traveling to 15 states since Thursday, raising by one count more than $140 million for his party since the campaign season began. Clearly discouraged, senior Democratic Party officials insisted they had not done so badly, sticking with their prediction that it would have a majority of the nation's governorships for the first time in 10 years by the end of the night. In other election news, there were reports that the new touchscreen voting machines failed in three polling stations in Florida. One voter in southern Florida called a local radio station to report they'd tried to vote for McBride, but the machine counted it as a vote for Bush. The voter said, "It did this three times. The polling worker finally said to me, we have to reset the machine." A Florida TV station reported hundreds of voters had abandoned the $50 million touchscreen voting system for hand counted voting papers. Also, the Voter News Service, which major news organizations rely on to project election winners and analyze voter attitudes, yesterday reported a computer glitch preventing it from providing accurate data. VNS is a consortium consisting of ABC, CBS, NBC, CNN, Fox, and the Associated Press. After its flawed reporting of the 2000 election, in which television networks used its information to make erroneous calls in the crucial Florida presidential vote, VNS vowed to revamp its system. The United States plans to introduce its final resolution on Iraq today to the United Nations, but Russia and France are withholding support until they can be certain the new version eliminates any, quote, hidden triggers in the wording that could allow the United States to invade Iraq. They want the possibility of force only to be considered in a second resolution if Iraq fails to comply with UN weapons inspectors. The country's chief financial regulator, Harvey Pitt, resigned last night as chair of the Securities and Exchange Commission. Pitt announced his resignation just before 9 p.m., around the time polls had already closed in much of the country. Pitt had come under increasing scrutiny in recent weeks over his recommendations on who should head the SEC's new accounting regulatory body. Pitt withdrew his first candidate after the accounting agency complained he may be too harsh on the very industries that Pitt had represented before he was chair of the Securities and Exchange Commission. Pitt then put forward William Webster, the former head of the FBI and CIA, but he failed to tell the other SEC commissioners that Webster had served on the audit committee of U.S. Technologies, a company whose financial deals and controls had themselves been questioned. Over 40 countries engaged in the diamond trade have finally signed an accord to stem the flow of conflict diamonds that have fueled the civil wars in Sierra Leone, Angola, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. Mining executives, diamond dealers, government ministers, and representatives from advocacy groups committed themselves to the UN-backed certification process in Switzerland after over 2 years of negotiations. Starting January 1st, the diamond industry will issue certificates to buyers promising the diamonds have been purchased from legitimate sources not involved in funding conflict. The London Guardian reports the industry feared a backlash was building comparable to the backlash that hit the fur trade. In this news from Paris, hundreds of prostitutes took to the streets yesterday to protest a proposed new crime bill that would make, quote, passive soliciting a crime. Under the proposed law, a person whose dress or attitude gives the impression he or she is soliciting money for sex could face 6 months in jail or a fine of $4,000. Prostitution is legal in France.
I've got to find another tax loophole for those rich donors before Bush's next fundraising dinner.
We're going to need more campaign cash in November. How can I make the Democratic platform even more corporate friendly?
I know.
What if?
Hey, you got Democrat in my Republican.
Hey, you got Republican in my Democrat.
Not much difference, actually.
Yeah, two bland tastes that almost taste the same.
I'm a law-abiding citizen. My debts I sure will pay. Yes, a law-abiding citizen. My debts I sure will pay. I hope war don't start and Uncle Sam have to send me away. I have never been in jail and never had to pay no fine. Never been to jail, never had to pay no fine. Need me a job, cause stealing ain't on my mind.
Odetta, Unemployment Blues, and Billionaires for Bush. You are listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. The Republicans seized full control of Congress by retaking the Senate last night. The Republicans now have control of the White House, the Senate, and the House. The outcome is a break with historic patterns in which the party that controls the White House almost invariably loses seats in midterm congressional elections. At the time of the broadcast, the numbers are not all in, but appears that one-third of registered voters came out across the country. The Republicans picked up at least 22 of the 34 contested Senate seats, giving them at least 51 of seats of the Senate. Republicans also strengthened their control in the House of Representatives. Also this morning, news organizations are projecting that Norm Coleman will be the winner in the tight Minnesota race for Senate. Former Vice President Walter Mondale joined the race a week ago following the death of Senator Paul Wellstone, and that is where we're going to begin today. We're joined by Ann Alquist. She is news director of KFAI Community Radio in the Twin Cities. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Ann.
Thanks, Amy. It's good to be here.
Well, it's good to have you with us. At this point, the race hasn't completely been called, though it looks like the various news organizations have said that Norm Coleman, the Democrat-turned-Republican contender, has won.
Yes, the Associated Press has called it for Norm Coleman. Our NPR affiliate here has not. They're just reporting on what the AP is saying. Walter Mondale has not conceded. He is scheduled to have a press conference at 9 a.m. this morning, regional time, and Norm Coleman has not declared victory either. So we're in a holding pattern right now. There are still, there's about 45,000 votes difference between the two, with Coleman leading.
Now, this number is very significant, 45,000 difference. Yet, you have 100,000 ballots that were thrown out. Is that right?
There were, I don't know the specific number, but yes, ballots cast for Senator Wellstone, absentee ballots, were thrown out, but the ones for Coleman were still counted. These absentee ballots for Norm Coleman were counted. And Minnesota election law is very clear that you cannot elect a candidate posthumously. And so that was the reason that was given why the absentee ballots cast for Wellstone were thrown out. And not only that, but just hours after Wellstone's death, the attorney general here, Mike Hatch, who is a Democrat, said that he thought the law would hold up, even though the DFL was chomping at the bit to file a lawsuit.
Now, let's get this straight. 100,000 absentee ballots, and the only ones of those that were thrown out were the ones where the vote was cast for Paul Wellstone. Those that were cast of the absentee ballots for Norm Coleman were counted.
Correct.
And the rationale for that, and what those who cast absentee ballots for Wellstone were told?
You cannot vote for a dead candidate.
And so what option were they given?
The option after the DFL, the Minnesota's Democrat Farmer Labor Party here in Minnesota, filed a lawsuit. They went to the Minnesota Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court here ruled that the Secretary of State's office here in Minnesota, on request, if people requested a new absentee ballot, they had to get it to them in time. But those people who wanted to cast a new vote had to get it here by 8 p.m. Tuesday before the polls closed, or show up in person, and that was it. There were no extensions.
And if people had cast absentee ballots because they were leaving the state?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it has been a hugely controversial and extraordinary time here because, of course, if they discount all the ballots, and this is the argument that the Attorney General Mike Hatch gave, if they discounted all the ballots for Coleman and for Wellstone.
Those are the absentee ballots.
The absentee ballots, correct. Then the voters who voted for Coleman are disenfranchised as well. And so they went ahead and just discounted the Wellstone ballot, the absentee ballots cast for Wellstone.
Isn't it also possible that once you had this new player in the race, the former vice president, Walter Mondale, that some people who voted for Norm Coleman would have switched their vote to Mondale?
That's an interesting question. But you know what? After the memorial service for Paul Wellstone, I don't think that was going to happen.
Explain what you mean.
I think the memorial service, which up until I think the first couple of hours or hour and a half, was very focused on Paul Wellstone, Sheila Wellstone, their daughter Marcia, the campaign staff, and so on. But after that, it really turned into a political rally, and that's what a lot of the analysts were saying. There was some harsh criticism, and even following it, the Republican Party had a rally the following night at O'Gara's in St. Paul, and they were making fun of the Democrats. They were making fun of the Democrats and how they handled the memorial service and how it turned into a political rally. And I don't think that served the DFL very well here. I think Minnesotans really don't respond well to what they perceive as being unfair play or using an inappropriate venue.
The governor, the independent governor, Jesse Ventura, who originally said he would allow the Democratic Party to replace Paul Wellstone until the race, you know,
not
selected
anymore.
A person, went for his own protege, Dean Barclay, out of anger at what happened at the memorial service. Is that right?
Yes, that is correct. He did appoint Dean Barclay, who has run for the U.S. Senate twice. Actually,
Now, this means that if there is a lame duck Senate, as has been talked about, that he would fill in. And if he were to vote with the Republicans, it would give the Republicans an advantage. But perhaps now that the Republicans have the majority in the Senate, they won't need the lame duck Senate to pass legislation that Bush wanted, like the Homeland Security Department.
Well, I don't think Barkley is there. Senator Barkley now is there to fill out the rest of Wellstone's term, and Wellstone would have served until the next session starts up in Washington D.C. And I'm afraid I don't know exactly when that starts. So he'll be there until all of this gets decided here, whether it's Mondale or Coleman who's been elected.
Is it expected that the race between Mondale and Coleman, which has been called now for Coleman, though neither one at this broadcast, 9 Eastern Standard Time, has made their concession or victory speech. Is it possible that this will mean a lawsuit? It will be challenged?
It is very possible. I think the DFL, I mean, it was very apparent that the Republicans had an edge by discounting those absentee ballots. I mean, as it stands right now, only 92% of the precincts have been counted, and it's 8:15 here in Minnesota. And the ballots that they're waiting on are coming from an urban area, Ramsey County, which is where St. Paul is located, where Norm Coleman was former mayor. And I presume that Mondale's people are probably waiting to hope urban areas, which tend to vote DFL. St. Paul is a strong union labor town, and I think they're hoping that that will put them over the edge, but they have to wait for the rest of the precincts to call in.
We've been talking with Ann Alquist, news director at KFAI Radio in Minneapolis. As we turn now to the news director of WMNF in Tampa, Florida, another major contest, the governor's race, mainly between the current Republican governor, Jeb Bush, the brother of George W. Bush, and Bill McBride, the Democratic contender. Robert Lori, can you talk about what happened in Florida with the victory of Jeb Bush?
Well, hi, Amy. The Democrat got swamped last night by Jeb Bush. I think one of the reasons is that special interest money flowed in. The NRA, the American Medical Association, a lot of other groups were active in the final weeks of the campaign. We're not going to know how much was spent for a while because of the way that the election laws have been rewritten in the state, but it looks like, according to some reports, that the Republicans outspent the Democrats in the governor's race 3-1. McBride, former head of one of the largest law firms in the country based here in Tampa, he did represent big corporations, but he also had an internal policy of corporate responsibility. His law firm went to bat for the victims of the Rosewood Massacre. His big issue was education. But the
Explain Rosewood Massacre for a minute.
Yeah, the Rosewood Massacre was it's a small town in North Florida that in 1923, the inhabitants, all of whom were, or most of whom were African-American, were either killed or run out of the town by a white mob, excuse me. The mob was looking for an alleged rapist, and many people were killed. We're still not sure to this day how many people were killed, but some of the survivors are still alive. And a few years ago, the law firm Holland & Knight that McBride represents went to bat for these victims, and got the state legislature to actually pay reparations to the victims of the massacre and to their descendants.
Hmm.
I think it's the first time in the history of this country that reparations have been paid to African Americans.
So,
anyway, so McBride's law firm went to bat for them. His big issue was education, but the incumbent governor Jeb Bush was able to question and I think raise doubts about how McBride would pay for his education proposals.
Hmm. Now, in this case, we have the same purged voter rolls from 2000. That is the voter rolls that Jeb Bush, as governor, and Catherine Harris, who also won for Congress, she was the Secretary of State as a Republican Congress member now, paid Database Technologies $4 million to purge the voter rolls. thousands of people were purged, mainly African Americans. Now there's been a legal settlement with the NAACP and the company that's taken over database technologies called Choice Point and the state, but those roles were never restored.
Yeah, that's true. And it was up to the individual election supervisor to either go along with the Choice Point list, which everybody admits was faulty, even the Republicans agree it was faulty. And depending on the political inclination of the election supervisors, some went along with the list and the others rejected it out of hand. The Democratic election supervisors tended to look at it and say, this is nonsense, we're not going to use it. And the Republican supervisors of elections used it, I think, as a cover to try to remove eligible Democrats from the roll. So you're right. That's still a problem.
Well, let's go to Eddie Hales because I know he has to leave. He's in Jacksonville, Florida, with the Advancement Project. We spoke to you yesterday. You were monitoring the polls. What did you find?
Well, we did find some problems at specific polls in predominantly African-American areas. There were improvements. I should acknowledge that. But one precinct in particular where there's a high concentration of fairly predictable voters. One local pastor told us 97% of the registered African-American voters in that area turn out on Election Day historically. And yesterday, apparently the precinct was understaffed, too few booths, long lines, frustrated voters, people who got to the polls before closing time and yet were turned away at approximately 6:55 p.m. We have a complaint, and we're actually following up on this complaint right now, of a woman who was in line before 7 p.m. and because of the long lines, because of the heat, she was experiencing what may have been an asthma attack and had to leave the building, had to leave the line, go outside the building. And once she went outside the building, election officials, we were told, would not allow her to return after she got fresh air, got her inhaler, and tried to come back and vote. They did not allow her to vote, and we're following up on that report now. Once we started receiving complaints about this specific precinct, it was late, and maybe 7:40 p.m. people were still in line. That's how many people were in line before 7 p.m. And we got there almost 8:20, and voters were still voting. That's how long the line was. And it told us that this was poor planning because those lines did not have to be that long. There should have been more booths, more election officials on the spot, and voters would not have had to be disenfranchised. What we also received were a number of complaints about poll workers requiring voters to show photo identification. And Florida law does, in fact, say that photo identification can be requested. But if a person does not have photo IDs when they come to the polls, they can sign an affidavit. And at least in one instance, a poll worker refused to accept an affidavit because, according to the complaint we received, the poll worker said that I'm not going to take the time to allow you to fill out an affidavit. If you do not have your photo ID, you have to leave. You cannot vote. So those are some of the complaints that we are following up on right now. Another complaint, and I don't have the precinct, and this is, we want to follow up on a particular complaint from a voter here in Jacksonville who said that she witnessed, because she was challenged herself at the polls and put into a certain line, and she was at the polling place for 45 minutes. And during the time that she was there, she said that every black person that came to vote was challenged and turned away. They were told they could not cast the provisional ballot at the district office, but had to go downtown. She saw persons who were challenged because they didn't have photo IDs. So we are now trying to locate this voter, find out which precinct she was she went to vote, and follow up on that complaint.
Anyhow, we have to break for stations to identify themselves. Thanks for joining us from Jacksonville, Florida, with the Advancement Project, one of the poll monitors. Rob, I'd like to ask you to stay on the line. We also want to look at a few ballot initiatives. We're going to be doing that around the country, but there were several interesting ones in Florida as well. Rob Lori, news director of WMNF in Tampa. You are listening to Democracy Now! Back in a minute. Tony Allen, Never Expect Power Always, here on Democracy Now! Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue looking at the challenges voters face, those who did go to the polls, again, the figures are around a third of registered voters went to the polls yesterday. We're also joined by Kara Feynman of the Voting Rights Project in Washington, D.C. She supervised the National Voter Hotline. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Kara.
Thank you.
What did you find nationwide?
We received many troubling complaints from voters across the country regarding ID requirements in states that do not require voter photo identification, problems with absentee ballots, problems with registered voters not appearing on the voter rolls at their precincts, precincts being changed without prior notification, in states that require the use of provisional ballots to when voters' eligibility cannot be confirmed, poll workers were not providing voters that opportunity, a lot of poll worker error and lack of assistance. Poll workers were not directing voters to their correct precincts. They were not offering voters the chance to confirm their eligibility when there was a problem with it. They weren't contacting central elections offices. Many voters complained that candidates' names that they had expected to be on the ballot did not appear on the ballot, specifically in Florida and Texas. In Texas, we received many calls from voters who were in line at closing time who were not permitted to vote. Still a disproportionate number of calls from Florida voters. A lot of calls from voters in Missouri, particularly regarding provisional ballots. That is a new law in Missouri where voters whose eligibility, again, cannot be confirmed, are required to be provided a provisional ballot.
And this is where Jim Talent, the Republican, narrowly beated Gene Carnahan, narrowly defeated Gene Carnahan.
Correct. And voters whose eligibility couldn't be confirmed, poll workers simply weren't offering them this opportunity. So we were instructing voters to go back to their precincts to demand that they're offered provisional ballots.
And then yesterday we reported on what happened in Baltimore, these anonymous flyers that went out in the African-American community saying people had to pay their back rent and their parking tickets and that voter and that election day was today, not yesterday.
Right. And of course, that is incredibly troubling that's a tactic that's been used throughout history, specifically to disenfranchise minority voters. And it's troubling that we're seeing the same type of intimidation and discouragement of minority voters still today.
And of course, there's just the overall issue of how many people turned out to vote in what is being seen as a sweeping mandate. It looks like the numbers are around a third of just the registered voters. And there are so many who aren't even registered, but of registered voters in this country.
Right.
We're joined also by Robert Lori, news director at WMNF in Tampa, as we look at both the races and the referenda around the country. Some interesting ones in Florida. You have Bill McBride defeated by the first brother, Florida Governor Jeb Bush, but his favorite issue, education. Florida voters agreed to cut public school class sizes to no more than 18 for lower grades and 25 for high school.
Yeah, exactly, Amy. And that's the interesting thing about this election. The kind of issues that the governor stands for were rejected in several cases on ballot amendments. Voters said yes to smaller class sizes. They said to reinstate the Board of Trustees, which protects the state university system from undue political influence. Right now, the way the governor has reworked the university system, he has almost total political control over every state university system or university here in Florida. Voters are saying no to that, and that was one of the main points of Jeb Bush's education reform. The one place where the people of Florida did agree with the governor was on the death penalty. What voters did in Florida, in essence, yesterday was to extend the death penalty to 17-year-olds and people under 18, which is a tremendous step backwards for death penalty opponents. But otherwise, on education issues, the people of Florida tend to disagree with the direction that the governor has taken us the past 4 years.
On the issue of education, voters in many states faced a series of initiatives. Bilingual education came under attack in two states. In Massachusetts, voters chose to ban the state's 30-year-old bilingual education program by more than a 2-to-1 margin. In Colorado, voters said no to Amendment 31, an almost identical measure to ban bilingual education. So in Colorado, bilingual education remains. In Massachusetts, it has been vetoed. We're going to go now to Tim Duncan, chair of the Vote No on Question 2 campaign in Massachusetts. Tell us what happened, Tim.
Well, I think in a nutshell, what's happening here is that Ron Unz, a right-wing California millionaire, is taking a very successful political program that he put together in California and moving it across the country. And I think what we probably failed to appreciate is that most of us were involved in this because of education policy and understanding that it's a very complicated issue in terms of how we teach English-learning children. And are used to discussing this on a policy level with professional educators, and weren't really equipped to deal with this on the political level with the slogans and teach children English messages that were developed and are obviously very successful. The difference between Colorado and Massachusetts was that we had Mitt Romney, the Republican that won the governor's race here, spent millions of dollars with this teach children English message. We had very little money to spend on advertising in the campaign, less than a tenth of what was spent on the other side. While in Colorado, they were fortunate enough to be funded sufficiently to counteract the advertisements that UNS brought in there. So they were able to fight it on a political level.
Gully Stanford is also with us, co-chair of English Plus campaign, which opposed the ban on bilingual education in Colorado. You're also a member of the State Board of Education of Colorado. Why do you think your stand ended up prevailing while in Massachusetts bilingual education was vetoed?
Well, first of all, my condolences to Massachusetts. I think UNS focused his wrath there. We're a local control state passionately committed to the independence of our 178 school districts, and I think we were able to get that going. I think we were able to get out the triple message. The fact that we had some funding to get the message out really did help. There's no one message to counteract the sugarcoating of English for the kids. We're all for that. But we found there were three messages, and one is the cost, the other is the punitive sanctions against teachers and principals, and the third was the restriction on parental choice. And we got some strange bedfellows. I mean, I was out there alongside some people who are pro-choice, pro-vouchers, but they saw this as a they saw this as a violation of parental choice. We were able to get the message out, and despite
when you say pro-choice, you mean pro-vouchers?
We were pleased, for instance, Governor Owens, the Republican governor of Colorado, actually joined in on this. It was one thing that both sides of the aisle could agree on. So, the voucher community, not unanimously, but a number of their leaders came on board with us on this, charter schools also.
So let's get this straight. What exactly does this mean for Colorado, and what does it mean for Massachusetts? Tim Duncan in Massachusetts. Does this mean the end of bilingual education in Massachusetts?
Well, what you've seen in California is that English immersion is not a workable program. Last year, less than
meaning seven. Kids getting nothing, no education in their own language.
Yeah, they promise it as a one-year solution. That's what the public buys into, is that in 1 year we're going to teach kids English. Well, the best they've ever done in California is get about 9% of the kids out each year. So these kids are now staying in these immersion programs. The majority of kids will be going into their fifth year in California into these immersion programs, where they're forcefully segregated out of the regular programs, where they're around English-speaking kids, forced into these segregated programs where they're around nothing but other kids that don't speak English, which is why they don't work very well. Hopefully we're going to do our best to avoid that in Massachusetts. What you saw in the vote here is that the communities that don't have English-learning children, that don't have to deal with the issue, voted strongly in favor of eliminating bilingual education. Communities that actually have the immigrant kids living there voted strongly to maintain the local choice, the ability of these school districts to implement the best programs possible that are already doing better than immersion in California, even in purely teaching kids English quickly. So it's going to be interesting to see how it plays out, that if the communities that don't have to deal with the issue can basically force the communities that do have to deal with the issue to adopt a program that they don't think works, that hasn't proven to work in California, that they don't want, and that they're now going to have to spend a lot of money on in a very tight fiscal situation to try to implement very quickly.
In Oregon, two of the most closely watched and intensely fought ballot initiatives did not pass yesterday. Measure 27 would have required labels identifying genetically engineered foods sold in the state. It's the first initiative of its kind in the U.S., and Measure 23 would have created universal health care for all Oregon residents. Zander Patterson is with us right now from Oregon, executive director of the Oregon chapter of Physicians for Social Responsibility. You endorse both measures which lost. Can you talk about them?
Well, the measures were excellent. It's just one of the most stark examples I've ever seen of power being money. Before, at the start of the campaigns, both measures were favored. The one to label genetically modified foods was favored by, about two-thirds of the voters in the polls. But then, in that campaign, $6 million of Monsanto and other corporate money rolled in, compared to, about $20,000 for the pro-labeling campaign. And so it just got drubbed. I haven't seen the latest results, but I think about 75% voted against it, even in the most progressive districts. And the campaign against that one was, spurious at best, alleging that, family farms would be run out of business and people would be paying $500 a year more for their food, which just doesn't jibe with common sense.
What was the corporate money that was poured into both of these campaigns? Where was it from, universal health care and the genetically engineered foods measure?
Well, mostly Monsanto and, the companies making genetically modified organisms, and then HMOs and insurance companies and pharmaceuticals for the health care. It was pretty grim, and there was not really much of a way to respond to it. They ran very effective campaigns. They got to all the editorial boards so that all the major media came out against both of them. And in that regard, I think the pro forces could have done a much better job. But in terms of responding in the mass media, paid advertising, it just wasn't even close. I think another thing that was reflected in this campaign is that the Democrats also just right down the ticket ran the most lackluster campaigns imaginable, also very heavily negative. And I think the people in Oregon offered them, or progressives, a wonderful platform to run on. We also had a great measure that I think did pass to raise the minimum wage and peg it to the consumer price index, and But the Democrats just steered way clear of all of these things and gave people nothing to vote for and got creamed themselves in most cases. And the governor's race was very close, but it should have been a runaway. So lack of vision and lack of money was pretty grim.
Back in Florida, Rob Lori of WMNF, the community radio station Pacific affiliate in Tampa, on health issues, voters by a 70-30% margin gave landslide approval to banning smoking in every workplace in the state, including 38,000 restaurants.
Yeah, I think it shows that there's a lot of common sense issues that voters here in Florida will go for. They approved that by overwhelming margins, just as they approved the education issues. They approved an animal rights issue. I think one of the funny things about this is that it shows the inaction of the Florida State Legislature, which is controlled by Republicans. They refuse to move on a lot of important issues. So voters just have to go around the legislature because it is stuck on a conservative agenda and doesn't move on the issues that people want. And that's one of the things that you see there in the smoking amendment, is that, you know, people are tired of the legislature looking the other way at some of these public health issues.
And finally, the issue of Catherine Harris and Jeb Bush as a team winning in both of their races. Catherine Harris going up against an old friend of Bill and Hillary Clinton from Yale Law School days in Sarasota area.
Right, Jan Schneider. Actually, you know, I think Schneider put on a better campaign than many people thought she would. She's a novice. Although she's a lawyer, she's not known for her public speaking ability. And she came a lot closer to beating Harris than many people thought. She ran a good grassroots campaign. She was a moderate to left candidate, especially critical of the Bush administration's record on taxes and the environment. And I think that had she had a little bit more money, she had next to no money. Catherine Harris had one of the best-funded campaigns in the state, and it was almost impossible to go up against her. But I think it shows that the people in that district, even though it was drawn so that Republicans outnumbered Democrats by almost 20%, for Schneider to do as well as she did, it shows that even Republicans are not as enamored of Harris as her reputation would indicate around the country.
Well, I want to thank you, Rob Lori, for being with us from WMNF in Tampa. We're going to go to break and then talk with candidates that didn't make it around the country but are gaining momentum, and they're Green Party candidates from California to Vermont to Maryland. There was a Green Party candidate in Maine, John Elder, who was elected to the State House of Representatives. Stay with us.
Every couple of years, you get the chance to participate in this pacifying dance. Hold your nose and vote. Now what if you got to choose which one of your hands you are gonna lose? And what if you had a say in which one of your eyes you were gonna have to give away? Then you might start to see the level of hypocrisy in what they keep telling me is a two-party democracy, where every couple of years you're gonna get the chance.
Hold your nose and vote. Andrus Jones, a listener, sent his music in. You are listening to Democracy Now! Breaking the Sound Barrier. I'm Amy Goodman. On Election Day, Green Party candidates ran in over 450 races across the country. In California, Peter Miguel Camejo gained over 5% of the vote in one of the most prominent Green races. Among victorious Green candidates in Maine, John Elder elected to the State House of Representatives. We'll talk with Green Party candidates across the country from Vermont to Maryland, and we'll begin in California with Peter Miguel Camejo. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
Your assessment of the race, and what exactly at this point do you are the figures for your race?
Well, it was a giant victory for the Greens, and people don't understand it, that we increased our vote by 400% in terms of the statewide race. And in San Francisco, we went to 16% and beat the Republican Party, became the second largest party. In San Francisco, we had victories of local candidates all over the state. We still don't know the total amount. I know even in small counties like Nevada, we had four or five candidates elected. The fact is, the big breakthrough in California was that our vote in the Latino community grew by 700% from what it was four years ago, and we now have much larger. In fact, in some places, the vote in the Latino community went 10 to 15% for the Greens. We got the first time we got endorsements of the whole Muslim community in California. So the Green Party has expanded its base, and possibly our vote was a third to half people of color in California. So the Green Party is very ecstatic that it is becoming a much stronger force. And last thing I want to say is that we made a lot of headway in convincing members of the state legislature to consider now IRV, that is having runoff elections, so we can democratize the electoral process in California.
Explain what you mean.
What's that?
Explain what you mean.
Yes, IRV is instantaneous runoff voting, that is to have a runoff so that when people vote, they're free to vote for whoever they want. We figure about half of the people that wanted to vote for the Green, as usual, did not. And by the way, let me just say that we took probably more votes from Simon, the Republican candidate, than we did from the Democrats, because what happened in this race was that the Democrats lost 20 to 25% of the vote they used to have in the Latino community. And there was a battle for that vote between the Republicans and the Greens. And the fact that we succeeded in taking a large part of that vote, otherwise that vote would have gone to the Republican. It probably would not have been enough for the Republican to win. But when people traditionally think Democrats, the Greens are only taking votes from the Democrats, that's wrong.
Now, Gray Davis did win in California, but his margin was not as big as people thought.
Right.
What plank did you run on? What were your campaign promises?
Well, there were a lot of very important issues. Wanted to raise the minimum wage, which is now lower than it was in 1968 when adjusted to inflation. Wanted more affordable housing. We are, of course, the party of peace, and I think that had an impact, certainly in San Francisco and certain areas that are much more pro-peace. They reflected by an increase in the vote of the Greens. We are a party that fought against racial profiling and other issues. We were trying to save the last 4% of our ancient forests. We're for renewable energy. We're against the death penalty and three strikes. But there's just a series of issues that penetrated and helped the Green Party improve its base in all sectors.
Linda Shade is also with us, Green Party candidate who did not win the state legislature in Maryland. You need about 22%, got about 13%, up against three Democrats who ran on a slate progressive leadership team. Can you talk about the race? And that race was brought into this race, saying that you were there to spoil a black Democrats race.
Right. It is a three-seat district, so the top three vote-getters win. And we went into yesterday really thinking that we were going to win a seat. In fact, we were even thinking we were going to come in second. And a very effective negative campaign went on in the last few days where both race and anti-Nader sentiments were mobilized, I think, to really shift a lot of votes at the last minute.
What planks did you run on?
My campaign theme was fresh air and clean politics, and I had a host of other issues as well, but the fresh air piece was a lot about me being an independent voice for progressive values. The district's about 100,000 people, and at the heart of it is a city called Tacoma Park, which is sort of called the Berkeley of the East. So we expect a lot of support there, and I don't have the precinct analysis yet, but I found that among Republicans, and there's a huge number of independents in this district, I found that that message of fresh air and clean politics was resonating really across party lines.
Anthony Polina is also with us, independent lieutenant governor candidate in Vermont. You've in the past run for governor, which has not yet been decided. Is that right?
Well, actually, the governor's race was decided this morning.
What was decided?
The Republican won the race for governor by, I don't know, I guess it's going to come out to be about 3 percentage points.
Mm-hmm. And your race?
Well, in our race, the Republican actually also won our race, but the important thing for us is that I received 25% of the vote. You know, it's very clear now that Vermont is, in fact, a three-party state. We get there's not a whole lot of talk about spoilers when you're getting 25% of the vote. The polls leading up to the election showed us in a, you know, a dead heat throughout a lot of the campaign. So we took votes, you know, or won votes from, you know, Democrats, Republicans, and Independents and others. So the other thing that was important about our race, in addition to getting 25% of the vote, was we were endorsed by the Vermont State Labor Council, the AFL-CIO, and a number of other labor unions, the Nurses Union, the United Electrical Workers, the State College faculty, Sierra Club, and a number of others, organizations that had never supported someone outside the Democratic and Republican Party before, other than our congressman, Bernie Sanders. So our campaign was very strong, and you know, I don't think there's anybody who's doubting that Vermont now is a three-party state.
It's interesting when you look at a state that has such a dominance of the independent parties, right? You have Jim Jeffords, who's an independent, and you have Bernie Sanders, the Congress member, independent. And it's the only congressional delegation between Senate and House that completely voted against war.
That's true. And, you know, being independent or outside the two major parties makes it easier to do that for sure. And you know, I think in Vermont more and more people are beginning to see that you vote for the candidate, you know, you vote based on issues, and you vote less based on party. In our case, you know, the Democrat never really solidified his Democratic base, and, you know, we were able to articulate the issues much more strongly than he was on, you know, a range of issues from single-payer health care to fair taxes to strong support for the environment. You know, it's interesting because the Democrat will try to say often, well, you know, the progressive and the Democrat, we're really the same on a whole range of issues. But when it comes right down to it, we're actually quite different. And part of our task is to, you know, convince more and more people to vote outside the two-party system, but also to just continue to talk about issues and make sure that people do understand the differences. And, you know, our message got through very strong this time, and you know, we're really excited about the future of third-party politics in the state. You know, I would mention, as the other person did from California, I think that there will be a strong movement for instant runoff voting in this state as well, because in our state, in Vermont, if no one receives 50% of the vote, the legislature then actually picks the winner. So they're going to pick the Republicans in this case, you know, because they should pick the person who gets the highest number of votes. But 2 years ago, in the governor's race, there was a lot of talk about the spoiler. And both the leaders of the Republican and Democratic parties both said, well, you know, we're going to fix this. We're not going to let this happen again. And yet neither of those major parties were willing to move the issue forward at all in the legislature. And, you know, in some ways we have to keep in mind that the other parties, they like being able to call people a spoiler, let's say. And the reason is that allows them to avoid the real issues. You know, don't vote for me because I'm better on health care. Don't vote for me because I'm going to lower your property taxes. Just vote for me because you don't want to elect someone else. You know, I mean, it's confusing for voters, and it makes voters consider voting out of fear. You know, if you vote for the progressive, you're going to end up with the Republican. You know, that's the Democrats' message. It's not about issues. It's about being afraid of voting your conscience. And we really have to get beyond that, and I think we're ready to start doing that here.
Peter Miguel Camejo, what about the debates, and how are you each faring when it comes to having your issues heard?
Well, Governor Davis, who, by the way, is considered quite corrupt by most people in California, manipulated the Republican primary by spending $10 million on it to make sure that the leading candidate there did not win and the more conservative candidate got nominated. And then he refused to debate, and he said that if I was in the room, he would not be in the room. In fact, there were three scheduled events where the Republican, the Democrat, and the Green would all be in the same room, different type of events, and every single one, Davis refused to attend. And when he finally got the Los Angeles Times to agree to allow a two-way debate, I was going to be inside the room. I had an invitation to attend. He told the the Los Angeles Times said, if they let me in the building, he walks out. It's that enormous fear of letting the issues, as was just pointed out by our candidate from Vermont, that this fear the Democrats of having an open debate on the issues. And I think the issue of getting runoff elections is so crucial to save American democracy, so people start looking at issues and voting their conscience and what they believe in, instead of this manipulation, which the campaign here was so manipulated in some levels that one Democratic Party candidate in Northern California put out a mailer implying that the Democrat was the Green. It actually said, I am the Green candidate, and actually used capital G to confuse voters. That was mailed to every registered Green in Humboldt County and Mendocino, where we're very strong. And these are the type of things that Democrats and Republicans have been doing to try to deny people a really to hear all the points of view of what exists, what choices you have.
Mm-hmm. Have you earned major party status?
Well, I don't know. In San Francisco, the Chronicle sort of put us, the Chronicle is the major daily newspaper there, San Francisco Chronicle, treated us as a major party to a great extent. And that's partly why our vote is so strong in San Francisco, where we actually came in ahead of the Republicans. But in most places, no, we are still treated as though we don't exist. That is, especially the Los Angeles Times was horrendous. They did polls where they asked people, if only the Democrat and Republican are running, who would you vote for? And then when they published the results, they didn't tell people that's how they did the poll. They did that for the lieutenant governor's race. Unbelievable manipulation of information.
And let me get each of your responses, starting with Linda Shade, Green Party candidate who didn't win for the Maryland State Legislature. Your response to the Republican sweep, both the fact that a third of the only a third of the registered voters came out, but the Republican sweep in the House and the Senate, your response to that?
Well, I think that the Democratic Party has some real soul-searching to do, and I think that's true at the national level, and I also think it played out in Maryland. We also, in the gubernatorial race, the Republican candidate also came through, and that is not a typical situation for Maryland, so that's what I would say. I think that people are losing faith in the Democratic Party, and, you know, I mean, it's just not new, but, you know, the abandonment of constituencies and issues continues, and I think people are, I think that bodes well for the Green Party as well as independents and as well as the Republicans.
Anthony Polina.
I would really echo a lot of that. You know, there's a real shift going on in the political landscape. You know, nationally, we certainly see it here in Vermont, and I think the Democrats have allowed themselves to essentially fail to address the issues that, that people are really concerned about. They have, for the recent years, been relying on the fact that they are slightly better than Republicans. You know, vote for us because we're not Republicans. They're not saying, here's a plan for universal health care. Here's how we're going to support the right of workers to organize and get, you know, livable wages and livable incomes. What we're seeing is the shift away from, I think, the Democratic message, which is a very weak message, towards a more, you know, in our case we call it progressive, but, you know, a different kind of message, one that is more directed at the needs of working people and the needs of the environment. And it really crosses party lines, which I think is very important. And I think the Democrats fail to inspire, you know, people because they fail to really lay out a vision.
Peter Miguel Camejo, do you think a Republican Senate at the national level would be any different than a Democratic senator when it comes to going to war with Iraq?
Yes, I think that part of the problem here is the low turnout favors the Republicans. But
on that note, we have to wrap it up. I want to thank you all for being with us. Democracy Now! Produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Anna Noguera, Alex Wolf, Mike DeFilippo, our engineer, music maestro. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!